Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome once again, everybody, to Blockbuster Mentality. I'm your host, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us. Hey, before we get started, make sure you're subscribed to us on whatever you're listening to, preferably iTunes. That would be great if you gave us a 5-star review and a rating and review. That would help us out a lot. Had a great conversation with Sam Levine. You might know him from Freaks and Geeks, The Schmodown, Drunk History. He's been on a few episodes of that. He was in Inglourious Basterds with Quentin Tarantino. I geeked out about asking and asked him about that. So, definitely stay tuned for that conversation. Dave, unfortunately, couldn't join us. He did come down with COVID, so definitely wish him a speedy recovery. But, Sam was great, and so glad he chose the film Quiz Show, which he was very knowledgeable about and had a lot to say about it, and it was great having him. So here is my conversation with Sam Levine. Are you still gonna be a married man soon? Is that
I am indeed getting married the end of April.
What did COVID put a halt on that for a little bit?
A little bit. We got engaged on February 29th of 2020. So we got
like
to
right
enjoy
before.
Almost 2 full weeks of like, hey, we're engaged, everything is still normal. And then it all ended on like March 12th.
Man.
Was like when the world stopped.
Yeah.
Like a day after Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson were like, hey, we have COVID. And then literally that was all it took for everyone in the world to go, ooh, this is a real thing.
Right. Yeah.
It happened to America's finest actor. It's over.
That's what I start. Yeah. The panic started coming in. It's like, oh my God, what if we lose Tom Hanks over this?
Exactly. Wait a minute. He's not just some random Chinese person. He's a real human.
Yes, exactly. Cause I was definitely one of those who, you know, was, oh, it's just the flu. Like, come on, everyone. And then the months went by and, I was biting my tongue a little. I was like, oh, whoops. Guess I was wrong. I think there's even recordings on the podcast of me saying how this is just
it's nothing, it's a blip, it's gonna blow right over.
It's right,
we've dealt with worse. I went when it first started, I went down the rabbit hole of like, what happened the last time we had that 1918 flu pandemic, and I learned so much about it. It was bad news. It was really, really bad news for a long time.
How long did that one last? Let's have a history lesson.
I mean, at best I can tell you, like, in terms of like things stopped, that only lasted a couple months because the economy really was tanking. And so then they were like, all right, well, let's open everything back up. You know, people just take care of themselves. And then over the course of like the next 5 years, like millions of people died.
That's,
it was because they tried it for like 8 months, like, okay, let's everybody protect yourselves. And they were like, all right, this is too much. But there wasn't enough of a global economy yet. So it really just tanked us. And it was bad news. Here's something fun. And I knew this before. So the reason they call it the Spanish flu was the flu was all over the world. But all of the other countries in the world didn't want to print in their newspapers that this flu was ravaging their people and their economies. They didn't want to put that in the papers because every country after World War I wanted to be strong. They wanted to make their citizens believe everything was fine. And so Spain was the only country willing to print in its national newspapers, hey, there's a really bad flu pandemic, and it's all over this country, and we're pretty sure it's everywhere else. But we can say for sure, Spanish citizens, protect yourselves, there's a really bad flu. So then every other country in the world was like, hey, hey, this Spanish flu is, blame Spain.
they're the
did
ones
not start oh. there. They just had it like everyone else, but they were the only ones willing to print it. So then that's how it got named the Spanish flu pandemic.
And that's why to this day, Spain still just gets under our skin. Just you know, it's just like
lousy Spaniards riddled with ancient flu. Yeah. So,
oh man.
Yeah. So, anyway, it was interesting. But hopefully, I don't know. There's, you know, you could look at it a bunch of different ways, but
yeah,
it's not going to end like that. It's going to be a slowly tapered off thing over many years.
Yeah, definitely.
It's kind of the bad news that nobody wants to hear.
Especially with the variants coming out and all that. It's just, yeah.
I really hope this is all on the podcast, by the way. I really want
to. Oh, yeah, it will be.
Great.
I was just about to say, I can't wait for a podcast where this subject does not, you know, come up. And, you know, we can just, you know, not talk about it.
We should be doing podcasts like the Hollywood is releasing movies and TV shows.
And what?
Where COVID just doesn't exist in that world.
I know. Do you find yourself even watching like older movies like, oh my goodness, why are all those people together now? Like,
Not older movies, because in my mind, I'm like, no, movies from 1986, yeah. Who cares? But like now when I watch new movies that have been shot in the last 2 years and they take place in present day, I'm like, well, this just doesn't feel right.
Right. Yeah.
Like 30 years from now, people are going to be watching this and assuming this is written about in history books, they're going to go, I don't understand. Isn't that movie set in 2021? How come they're not wearing masks and distancing?
Yeah. What's that all about?
Wasn't that a big deal for you guys? But then I don't know. I mean, you watch, you know, Chariots of Fire and then dealing with, no, that's not the right era.
Yeah, not so much, but
there's not a whole lot of movies set in 1918, but you get the idea.
Not so much. And yeah, I hope your wedding, you know, stays on track. It doesn't get pushed back any further. So just a couple things I just wanted to touch on with your career before we get into the movie.
Sure.
Obviously gotta do that whole spiel and everything. I do want to know how did the whole you being on you and Kevin Pollak, how did you two start getting together? How'd you get on that show?
So we met at a NAMBLA convention. And that joke only works if you know what NAMBLA is.
I was just about to say, pleading that, ignorance
that's,
here.
That's just it's a truly terrible joke. I've been using it for way too long. I have to retire it. NAMBLA is the North American Man-Boy Love Association.
Oh, okay.
It's like the KKK, but for pedophiles. So anyway.
Is that a South Park thing? It sounds like a South Park thing.
They did do it in early season of South Park, I think. But then it was like the National Association of Marlon Brando. impersonators or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
The real story is Kevin and I met in the year 2000 at the Friars Club roast of Rob Reiner.
Oh,
when I was but a lad of 18, and then we reconnected a handful of years after that. A lot of mutual friends, and we were going to shoot this video that never actually happened, but born out of that failed attempt was one of my dearest, most wonderful friendships. So, he may be a West Coast Jew and I an East Coast Jew, but we are cut from the same cloth.
Yeah.
We're just the Jews would say mishpucha. Which means family. We're too similar in too many ways. We're both just crotchety Jews.
Yeah.
We share a very similar, you know, sick sense of humor and, we love poker and comedy. So it was just a very fitting friendship.
Well, yeah, because I always loved that show, the interviews and everything. It was just, it was, I don't want to say it wasn't the first of its kind, but I think it definitely kind of was, you know, in there with, you know,
we were, I mean, hey, I like to, you know, shows. Kevin even forgot about this. We predated WTF Marin show by like 6 months.
Really?
Really?
I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah, you guys did. Yeah.
No, we were one of the grandfathers, and to our credit, we were one of the very few that had video, and to my knowledge, the only one that was live streaming these interviews.
Yeah.
Wow. In 2009 is when the podcast started. So yeah, in like March of 09, I want to say. So yeah, we were pretty cutting edge for the time.
It's crazy, but yeah, because I remember thinking like back, like I think Tom Green did like a web show like in 2007, 2008 or something, and I was just like, I enjoyed it and watched it, but I was like, how is this going to last? People aren't going to sit at their computers and watch this. Sure. Little did I know that there'd be a little, you know, devices that you can take anywhere and watch anything that has ever been created, wherever you are. So, you know. Little did I know.
Little did he know.
And then I also have to ask, because Christian Harloff has kind of been my I was lucky enough to express my gratitude to him, because he's kind of who started me on this journey, and
how wonderful.
I've become owe my gratitude to him on being a successful show at this point. He was an inspiration. How did you two get together, where you were doing stuff with the Schmodown? For people who don't know, it's a movie trivia show that has grown and grown and grown. How did that come about?
So I met Christian Harloff and Mark Ellis. We were all on an episode of Doug Benson's podcast, Doug Loves Movies. Back in the summer of 2011. And I had a great time with those guys. And then they invited me onto their podcast, the Schmoes Know podcast. And I did a few episodes of that. And then those were always super fun. And then it was a few years after that, that the Schmodown, as it is now, was sort of born. And I caught it and said, hey, are you kidding? How did you not call me? You know, I'm a movie trivia, you know, fanatic. Yeah. and so Harloff said, oh no, I wanted to build it. I wanted to build it before I bothered you. I was like, yeah, get the hell out of here. Come on. So then I got on as soon as he let me. And, the rest after that, has been a super fun ride.
That's great, man. Yeah. It's amazing what he's built there, and yeah, definitely kudos to him, and you know, it's just good stuff, and it was cool seeing you there and all that. Are you still involved at all? Because I've kind of fallen away from it a little bit.
I am. So I played for a while, then I retired from playing, and the last then I was the you know, the de facto commissioner for a while. Ooh. The last two seasons I was a manager. They had factions in the Schmodown.
Yeah.
And so I was managing a faction, The Usual Suspects, and we're still figuring out what we're going to do for the new season, which is coming up in a few weeks. So I don't want to say the wrong thing. So I'll just say that, you know, stay tuned. We're working on it. We're figuring it out.
I hope I'm not being too forward here, but do you get compensated for this?
Do I get compensated? Barely. there is calling it a stipend. I mean, the bottom line is everyone doing that show does it because they want to be there and it's something fun for them, not because there's any money in it.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Just, you know, thought I'd throw that out there, you know.
Yes. Make no mistake. If you were a fan of the Schmodown, know that everyone participating is there because they enjoy it, not right. because there's money in it.
They're there because they want to be there. They're not there because, oh, okay, yeah, I'll take that.
No one's chasing the big money on that.
That's right. And then one more thing I'll ask before we get into the movie real quick. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask your experience with Quentin Tarantino. You were in Inglourious Basterds. I think I go back and forth. It might be my favorite Tarantino movie.
Sure.
It's in top three, that's for sure.
Okay.
So when you before you are cast in that movie, what I mean, I assume you were a Tarantino guy.
Oh, huge.
Yeah. That's, I mean, how can you not be?
If you're a film lover, how can you not?
Yeah. Exactly. So I mean, walk me through the call. When you get the call, what was that
I mean, experience. there's a 40-minute version of this story, but I'll give you the abridged one.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that's
fine. Yeah, just I'd met Quentin here and there in L.A. And when I knew that he was casting that movie and specifically looking for, you know, military age, young Jewish, funny guys, I thought, well, if I can't book this, I got to just quit acting.
Yeah.
Like, I got to at least get in there and read for this. And so I was very happy that he wanted to read me. And when you audition for Quentin, you audition with Quentin. Like, he reads with you, right. Which is very unusual in the casting process. And so I went in and I read, met with him a couple times, and I read for a variety of roles. Yudovich, Donowitz, maybe another one. I don't remember. It's all a blur now.
Nazi role, because I just wanted to be in a...
I went in and I was there for a while reading with him and just sort of shooting the shit, and I hope I can curse. Okay, great. And then I felt really good about it, and I left, and I was like, okay, I feel good about that. It's out of my hands now. I did everything I could do. And then I heard nothing for 2 weeks, and I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I was starting to hear, like, casting announcements were being made, like, he's picking his people, and I was going crazy. So I left town. I flew to Chicago, and I started going to Cubs games because that's my safe place. When I'm on edge, and then that's where I was when I got the call from my people, and they're like, "Hey, you want you to play Hirschberg?" Yeah, great. It was the call I'd been waiting for, and working with him is everything you hope it would be and more.
Like, yeah,
he is a fucking genius.
Well, even the audition process. I mean, I would assume as an actor that just shows just how much, you know, he's invested in his work and, you know, wants to be involved in everything. I mean, it just shows just, I think, his love of movies, which we all have, and it's just hearing him talk about movies is just, you know, I could do that for hours and hours. It's just,
I agree. And here's one thing I'll say about him. There are plenty of writer directors, and you hear the word precious, like, oh, it's precious. I will say this about Quentin. I think to him, his stories are precious. Like, he cares about the story and how it's told, but the words are not precious.
Yeah.
Like, you can make, not all of them, but you can make some of the lines your own.
Yeah.
Like, he'll always have the conversation with you. You're like, but I want to do it, but this isn't, I don't think this is how the guy, you know, the character would say it. He'd say, well, how would the character say it? How do you feel he would? And if you give it, you convince him, you make a strong case, he'll go, yeah, you're right. Let's do it that way. There are other writer directors, and I won't name them, but the words are precious. Like, if you attempt to say, well, I don't think he'd say, you know, together, he'd say, group together. Nope. You say the words exactly as they're written. You don't think on my set. You say the words as written, and you do what I do. And there are other writer directors, and I've worked with them, who are like that. And I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah.
I think filmmaking truly is a collaborative process. Obviously, the director, especially if it's a writer director, you know, they're going to have the ultimate say. But there are other writer directors who won't even have the conversation with you.
Well, I mean, it goes down to sports. It's, you know, the coach has to trust his players, you know? Yep. I mean, there might be certain play calls, but what you choose to do on that play, how you execute it, it comes down to the players. You have to trust it. And all right, you want to do this? Go ahead and do that. You know, yep. Some coaches are like that, which is great. Other coaches are like, hell no. And they, you know, they just fall and are sitting at home right now watching the playoffs. So didn't you have to create your own backstory?
We did. Yeah. So we all got to Berlin where we shot the movie, and we had 2 full weeks of rehearsals, which in the film world, that is unheard of, because that means the studio is paying the actors to be there, you know, on the clock, but they're not shooting any film. So just from a cost perspective, that is the studio setting money on fire with nothing to show for it. Studios do not do that unless you're Quentin Tarantino.
Right.
So yeah, we were all there rehearsing with Quentin. And one of his big things was the first time he sat down with all the bastards was, so you guys have read the script. I want to hear what you think your character's backstory was, what led them to the first time we see them in the story, in that lineup. How did they get there? Yeah. And in fairness, nobody knew that question was coming until he asked it. Like, no one was prepped on that. And so that sort of separated, in my mind, the difference between the actors who were more like classically trained, you know, who sort of do that automatically whenever they get a role. And then there were the other actors who had improv backgrounds, who, even if they hadn't thought about it before that very minute, were able to come up with something pretty good. Right. And then the guys who had nothing and really had not thought about it until that very second and got put on the spot. And there was at least one actor whose answers were not satisfactory to Quentin, and he was summarily released from the project after that.
Oh, wow. You know,
gotta
take it serious.
That's sort of the thing is, Quentin was, he's not afraid to let people go.
Yeah.
If you're not doing exactly what he needs you to do, wants you to do, you know, he'll give you a couple chances. He's not a monster, but if you can't get there, all right, thanks for playing.
Yeah. I mean, it's his baby. It's his, you know, if it's not his vision, I can understand that. And I'm geeking out right now over this, but, we're going to get to the movie. Were you there for the bear Jew scene where he,
of course.
Well, I couldn't remember if your character was there,
but there in the ditch. We shot that over the course of a week.
You know, obviously it's an intense for the audience. Mm-hmm. How intense is it for you guys when you're standing there watching that? Like, is it, you're just like, he's, you know, just playing dress up. Like, is it intense at all? Are you nervous?
When Donowitz beats the Nazi to death?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was more fun for us than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Like, it's, you know, obviously you're right there, you know, it's fake. It's, you know, it's just
right. So, I mean, we're there and I know what props were used. Like, I knew the difference between the real baseball bat and the foam baseball bat.
Right.
That the actor Richard Sammel actually got struck with. I knew the difference between actual actor Richard Sammel and the dummy.
Yeah.
You know, that we shot from behind so you could hit him with the real baseball bat. And we were all excited to watch that get shot and filmed because, you know, it's a crazy scene.
Right. Yeah.
And I was very excited to watch how it all got edited together at the premiere and how crazy it looked.
Yeah.
But they shot that for days.
And you're just numb to it by that point.
I don't know. Not numb. It was beautiful. It was incredible. You know, but it was fun. There was nothing, there was nothing scary about it for us. Like, that was just fun.
Ah, good stuff. I love, again, one of my favorite Tarantino movies, and yeah, great talking to someone who was a part of it. So appreciate you indulging me there.
My pleasure.
We obviously on the show, we have people on the in the industry come on and break down a film with us. My co-host Dave unfortunately couldn't make it. He came down with COVID, as we were talking about earlier. He's doing better, just not 100% yet, but
hang
shout
in there,
out
Dave.
To Dave. You're the man, and can't wait till you're back. We like to break down a movie, just, you know, casually, just kind of talk about it and just what you got from it and all that, and we can break down as much, we can go on tangents, we can, you know, it's free form, my friend. Now you sent me a list. You sent a list over of movies.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the reasons I picked this, because I sent it over to Dave and he's like, oh, I love quiz show. And I was like, all right, great, we'll do quiz show. And he's not even here to discuss it.
But I feel bad. We could have rescheduled, you know.
No rescheduling. No. You sent a whole list, but why did you pick this movie? I know you sent several movies, but why was this movie in your list?
It is one of my favorite movies. It may be in my top 10 all time. I think it is a very intriguing story. I think specifically the way Robert Redford tells the story is pretty great. Because when you're watching this movie, you actually sort of see the POV of three different protagonists: Herb Stemple, Charles Van Doren, and Richard Goodwin. And that's really hard to do when you're telling a story. Any story is to get the viewer to, I don't want to say sympathize, but understand the POV of multiple protagonists in a sympathetic way, especially with two out of the three of them. I'm always a sucker for movies that are based on true events. And in this particular instance, like in just about every movie you've ever seen that's based on true events, they take artistic license. The events in the movie do not really happen like they did in real life. And in real life, Charles Van Doren had long been off the program 21 before the Congressional Subcommittee investigation began. The way he got on the show is not really how it happened. The way he met Richard Goodwin isn't really the way it happened, but that's okay. I'm okay with it. I've since read a lot about Van Doren talking about the difference between the movie and real life, and even he is okay with just about everything. My favorite thing is his biggest bone to pick with the movie is there's an end title card that says what happened to Charles Van Doren at the end of it, that, you know, after he was left Columbia University in his teaching post, he went to work for Encyclopedia Britannica, and then he never taught again, is what it says in the end card. And Van Doren's like, that's not true. I mean, it took 20 years for him to get, you know, re-credentialed somewhere or whatever, but he's like, I did teach. So I wish they hadn't put that there. That's not accurate.
At least give me that, you know.
But I guess if that's your biggest bone to pick with the story, then that tells me that they told a pretty good version of it.
Yeah.
And so that's what you want to hear is from the people who lived it. If they're okay with the way it's told, then I'm okay with it as a viewer.
Yeah, because, I mean, like you said, I mean, the true story, you have to make it movie friendly. You have to, you know, put in the drama and make it more intriguing, because you know, the real story might not be, it's interesting, but it might not be, you can make it more interesting, you know, with especially someone like Robert Redford, you know, doing his thing. Like you said, you got three, you know, kind of protagonists, I guess, and it's I'd say you do kind of sympathize, you know, with them a little bit. My thing, I mean, for people who haven't seen it, we are gonna be, you know, talking spoilers and all that, but hey, it's a almost 30-year-old movie, yeah. So get over it.
It's 28 years old. Do yourself a favor. Check out Quiz Show.
Exactly. But yeah, it kind of starts off with, you know, John Turturro. He's the character that's been, you know, the champion of this quiz show. 21, was it 21 questions, I think it's
just
called.
Just 21.
21. And, you know, he's been on a roll. But then, you know, the producers, namely the advertiser, who is played by the great Martin Scorsese. Yeah.
Geritol Pharmaceuticals.
Yep. And he's like, all right, we this guy's plateaued. We got to get him out of here, you know. And so they want him to throw the match, if you will. That's when it starts to get interesting, because you got this kind of up and comer who came into audition, which is Ralph Fiennes' character, Charles Van Doren, and he's like, why do they want him so bad? Is it that he's charismatic and, you
right.
know?
So Herb Stemple had been the reigning champion on 21 for many, many weeks. And the ratings were starting to dip. The people were getting tired of him. And, you know, the sponsor of the show, Geritol Pharmaceuticals, wanted, okay, I think it's time for change. We got to spice things up. So the producers of the show, Dan Enright and Al Freeman, were on the lookout for, okay, who can we get to be the new champion for a while to get people reinterested in the show? And that's where Charles Van Doren came into play.
Yeah.
So in the movie, Van Doren comes in to audition for another NBC game show called Tic-Tac-Doe. But then Al Freeman suggests, hey, I think this is the guy we should bring in to replace Stemple as the champ on 21. And so that's sort of where it was born out of, because Van Doren, while nowhere near as attractive as Ralph Fiennes in real life, he was a more, if I may, Aryan looking, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, scholar.
Right.
He was a teacher at Columbia. The Van Doren name was sort of one of the more famous intellectual New York City names, whereas yep. Herbert Stemple was a working class guy from Queens,
yeah,
a Jewish working class guy from Queens. I'm allowed to say it like that because I'm very Jewish.
Yes.
And so that's sort of the idea was, all right. So you guys are tired of the Jewish guy. We'll bring in a perfect, you know, Aryan guy who's smart and charismatic. And so that's sort of what happened.
A Jewish guy with a brown tooth.
What, dead tooth,
He keeps insisting that he'll get a cap on it, and, uh-huh. you know, it'll everything will be good.
Right. So the idea is that, and I guess you said we're going to talk spoilers here, so.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So the truth is that the reason Stemple had been doing so well on the show for week after week after week, as, by the way, had numerous contestants before him, was because this was back in the days before the FCC cared what happened on game shows, and the producers regularly fixed them.
Yeah.
And this was not a commonly known thing, that most game shows you watched on TV up to that point were fixed, because the producers simply wanted the most compelling outcomes to happen. They
right.
liked fun champions that you could root for. They were not interested in chance. They wanted compelling storytelling.
Yeah.
So, hey, the underdog, the blue collar guy from Queens, he can be smarter than anyone. That seemed like a great program to them. So they simply gave him the answers.
Yeah.
Of all the questions.
I love how we find that out, too, because
right.
at first we don't know. We just know that he blew the match. You know,
right.
they told him what answer to give. We're thinking, okay, he's been given the right answers this whole time.
Yep.
And then once we find out that Charles Van Doren has been given the answers, we don't... we find out later then that also Stemple has been getting the answers,
right?
Which was a revelation, you know, in the movie. And it's like, oh, okay, so they're just doing this with everyone. It's all about what's popular right now, you know, like mm-hmm. like you said. I mean, the ratings are now plateauing. They're yep. maybe going down a little bit with Herbie, John, who's played fabulously by the great John Turturro. Mm-hmm. But you know, they're sick of it. And he's from Queens, which isn't New York, according to Martin Scorsese, which is funny.
Is such
because,
a dig, by the way.
It's funny though, because Scorsese is actually from Queens, so you know, he's allowed to say that.
Right.
So they're like, all right, let's get this scholar in that people will cheer for, and that's when they bring in Ray Fiennes. But yeah, it's interesting in that aspect, but the law comes in to play here, you know, the Supreme Court.
It's a congressional subcommittee.
Congressional, yeah, yeah, right, yeah. Which is that's where Dick Goodwin comes in, mm-hmm. and he's kind of investigating things and what. I mean, ethically, I mean, what's I'm just going to be play devil's advocate. What's sure. the big deal? What's the big deal here?
The big deal was that the television viewing public thought they were watching a fair game. And that's what made it so interesting, was they wanted to watch, you know, two people play a fair game. And when Dick Goodwin, through his investigation, learned it's fixed. And I mean, the movie doesn't get into it, but he basically discovered they're all fixed.
Right.
You know, he thought, well, no, the public has a right to know if they're watching scripted entertainment or real entertainment, you know, nonfiction. And yeah. and because there was no oversight over the FCC and these television shows and the networks. I mean, what you have to understand is the events in the movie took place in the mid-50s, in the mid to late 50s. So in reality, the events in the movie and then all the congressional stuff actually stretched from like 1956 to 1959, but they truncated everything to make it look like it happened over, you know, a couple months. And at that time, you know, television as we know it was still kind of fairly new. I mean, yeah. anything you saw on television that wasn't a film scripted show in Hollywood was shot live.
Yeah.
21 aired live on television.
Well, even, yeah, I mean, his father, Ray Fiennes' father in the movie, yeah. you know,
Paul,
he doesn't even have
Paul Schofield.
Yep, he doesn't even have a television, and he right. gets one for his birthday, so he's able to watch his son on TV, you know, on this quiz show. Yeah. I love that, you know, the dynamic between him and his father in this movie. I think it's it plays with Ray Fiennes' morals a little bit, you know, like, am mm-hmm. I doing the right thing? Should I just, you know, give it up? Which eventually he does. He mm-hmm. he blows the answer. To digress a little, John Turturro, when he actually gives the wrong answer to Best Picture of 1955, which
the answer
was,
is Marty. He's told to say on the waterfront.
Marty, yep. And why what's his threat here to not do it?
So the idea is when Dan Enright, the character of Dan Enright, played by the wonderful David Paymer, when he's the executive producer of the show, and he tells Herbert that he needs him to get the answer wrong and he's going to lose the game. And so you say, well, why doesn't he just say the right answer? And the reason is Herb had been on the show at that point for like 8 or 10 or 11 weeks or something like that. And he'd won all this money. And if he doesn't give the answer that Dan wants him to give, the risk he runs there is, well, now Dan's going to hate me. The network is going to hate me. They're never going to want to do business with me again. And yeah. even if he gave the correct answer there, what's that going to get him? He's going to come back for one more episode, and then they're simply not going to give him the right answers anymore. And he's certainly going to lose the next episode. So at best, he gets one more episode out of it.
True.
And now he's angered everyone at the show and network level.
Yeah.
So NBC would never let him back in the room again. But if he plays ball and he does what Dan Enright asks him to do, maybe there'd be more of a life for him in television afterward. You know, even at the time, NBC still had a very high functioning radio arm of their business. So
because he kept talking about the panel shows to get on a panel
shows were very popular in that era. Panel shows being basically anything that wasn't a network drama or comedy. There were plenty of other game shows that relied on a panel of celebrity guests, you know, like What's My Line, To Tell the Truth, I've Got a Secret. All of those had celebrity panelists who were trying to, get the right answers to facilitate the game. And he wanted to be one of those.
Yeah.
Now, sort of the hope.
What's Dick Goodwin's role in this? What are your thoughts on him? Because I mean, he goes in there, just starts kind of investigating, like, you know, what's going on here. He finds the one guy who, you know, sent himself the answers like 2 days before the show, and then he ends up trying to protect Charles, and he just wants the NBC guys to get the fall. Is this sort of a circumstance of him just kind of, I'm investigating this guy and kind of came to like him and now I'm friends with him. And
right.
So in
reality, Dick Goodwin, who really did, he worked for the Congressional Subcommittee on Oversight. It's an oversight committee. So in reality, what had happened was in 1956 or seven, there actually was a grand jury investigation into what was going on with 21. And a lot of people testified in front of that grand jury, including Charles Van Doren, and all of them perjured themselves.
Yeah.
They all lied and said, no, the show's not fixed, because Dan Enright and Al Freeman told them, we're the only two people who can ever admit the show is fixed, and we're never going to say that. So you can perjure yourselves, because as long as neither of us say the show is fixed, no one can ever prove it. And so Van Doren, along with a long list of other former contestants, all said, no, the show's not fixed. And then that grand jury, those findings were then placed under seal, meaning the findings were not released to the public. And that was really weird.
Yeah.
It was a year and a half, 2 years later when the Subcommittee on Oversight caught wind of that and noticed the irregularity that the findings were under seal. So then Dick Goodwin was tasked with investigating that, and he did. And in his investigation, he basically went back and talked to everyone else in that who had testified in that grand jury and realized, I don't think anyone was telling the truth. So he didn't really care about any of the contestants. He cared about the system that allowed this to happen, starting with the executive producers, Enright and Freeman, and then moving up to NBC executives, and then moving beyond that to the sponsor who was funding everything. He realized that the system was corrupt all the way to the top. So to go after the contestants wasn't important to him. That's like going after, you know, the guy smoking weed in 1989. You don't care about the guy smoking it on his balcony. You care about the guy who sold it to him, where he gets it from, where that guy gets it from. What corrupt border official is letting it get into the country? You want to go after the big cheeses, not the end user.
Right.
So Goodwin had no interest in going after the contestants, who he personally didn't blame for doing what they did. I mean, these were regular people who were offered, hey, you want to be famous? You want to win tens of thousands of dollars on this
guaranteed
crooked game
money.
Show? Who's not? Everyone would say yes to that. He didn't care about them.
Absolutely.
He cared about the NBC people.
And what you alluded to with, you know, the perjury and everything, I even read, I think I read correctly that technically what they did by giving contestants the answers and fixing the games wasn't illegal. It was the lying.
Right. Know, it was the lying to the grand jury.
Right.
It was actually exactly. the only yeah. illegal thing they ever did. And so that's really what the actual real world congressional subcommittee hearings were on, were about the perjury charges for the people who lied to the grand jury. But because that isn't terribly cinematic and it would take way too long to tell, they just sort of yeah. made the hearings in the movie the one and only time testimony was given.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, in real life, there were also a lot more investigators than just Dick Goodwin. But for the story, to the cleaner storytelling purposes, that's how they did it. And in real life, Dick Goodwin did have a little bit of a relationship getting to know Van Doren. In reality, they weren't terribly close. I don't think Dick Goodwin spent time at the Van Doren family home. But, yeah. you know, for storytelling purposes, I love that they made that leap because it better illustrated Goodwin's actual concern, which is I am not interested in embarrassing the contestants and making right. any of them testify that they didn't really know the stuff they say they knew. He was only interested in any of the contestants who willingly came forward to say that. He wanted their testimony to help. Sort of convict Enright and Freeman and the NBC people. And so that's where the guy who asked me about James Snodgrass, who was a Greenwich Village, you know, beatnik. He was the one who had been on the show for a couple weeks before Van Doren, before Stemple, who sent himself all the questions and answers, registered mail 2 days before he appeared on the show to prove that he knew the questions and answers before the live appearance that he had on the show. And yeah. that's what ultimately was used to convict. And I say convict, nobody actually went to jail. Enright.
Right.
And Freeman, that so they were fixing the show.
Does he do that just in case this blows up?
He did it because he never knew when he might need to prove
yeah.
that the show was fixed. He did it to protect himself and, you know, make sure that he had something resembling evidence that they were fixing the show.
Yeah. I would assume in this day and do you think anything's happened like this since then?
Lord, no, because this is what got Congress to change the FCC's rules on game shows. And that if you're watching a game show, there has to be the element of fairness in it. Now, where it gets a little gray, if you really yeah. want to get into it and go on a little tangent here, is there is a gigantic difference between how the FCC views game shows like Jeopardy or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire versus competition or reality shows.
Right.
They do not fall under the same banner as a game show.
So like a Survivor or, right. you know, like Amazing that
is
a, Race.
That's
or...
not right. That is not looked at by the FCC the same way they look at Jeopardy. So the element of fairness, the lack of scripted elements by the show's producers, manipulation of potential outcomes by the show's producers, those are not verboten. In competition yeah. shows.
I did not know I was going to get a game show expert on the show. So this is great. Yeah. Have you ever met or worked with anyone that was in this movie?
I've met Ralph Fiennes, who's wonderful. I've met Redford, who is so charismatic and charming, it's ridiculous. God, I hope he fucking lives forever. What a brilliant fucking guy he is.
If you met someone that was a total dick, would you even say it?
I mean, I've met plenty of assholes, and I may have name checked them on previous podcasts, but I've stopped doing that because yeah. it's in bad taste. You know, I'm happy to tell you all the wonderful people I've met, but rest assured, there's plenty of assholes in Hollywood, and yeah, I've met a lot of them. yes, come to think of it, I've met a lot of people who have worked in this movie, but I've actually never asked anyone who worked in this movie about their experience on it. I'm not really in the habit of doing that in my playful conversations with other actors that I meet. I don't generally ask them what was it like to work in that movie because they're not guests on my podcast. We're just chatting in the real world.
Exactly.
But yeah, I've met Paymer and Redford and who else have I met from this movie? I guess I've met Rob Morrow and
Hank Azaria.
And oh God, I used to play poker with Hank Azaria. Sure.
Oh,
Who else?
Is he a good poker player?
He's a great card player. Yeah. And Christopher McDonald, who plays Jack Barry, the host of the show.
Oh yeah. Christopher. Oh good. Yeah. Shooter McGavin, man. Shooter McGavin. Rob Morrow. Have you met him?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm trying to think what else I've seen him in.
Oh, well, he was on Northern Exposure for years. That's how he got a start. I mean, that was the thing that brought him to most people's knowledge. And then he was on that show Numbers with my pal David Krumholtz for a long time.
Yeah. I do love, I had the quote up here, the final kind of... courtroom, whatever you want to call it, the congressional, the thingamajig. Where is it? Where's the quote? Ray Fiennes says it. It's beautiful. Ooh. Oh,
I could just do the whole thing for you by memory.
Well, when he's talking about, he's never built anything.
Right. I've spent a great deal of my life thinking I've accomplished more. I've done more. I've created more than I've actually done. I flew too high on borrowed wings.
Borrowed. Yes.
Yes.
Such a great line. It kind of gets you, and you, it's that, realization that I grew up privileged, and he's admitting to himself that
I've had all the breaks.
Yeah. And he took the easy way out on the show, they're giving me the answers. I'll do it. Like, cause he even said just give me the questions and I'll look up the answers or something. Like he was at least willing to do some work egregious. And right, exactly. But yeah, I love that. I know that wasn't really said in real life. It was put in the movie.
Some of what he said in real life is in the movie.
Oh, okay.
Because that was a real congressional hearing, so they did write it all down.
Yeah.
I believe the phrase, I was involved, deeply involved in a deception, is taken directly from his testimony. He said, first I lied about what I knew, then I lied about what I did not know.
Yeah. And I appreciate, Dick's face, when he's saying that, because he's like, I didn't want to take you guys down.
He had no interest in any of the contestants who didn't voluntarily come forward, like Stemple, like Snodgrass. He didn't want to parade them up in front of that committee.
Definitely.
But the ones who came up voluntarily, he said, I need you to get to Enright and Freeman, with the hope that Enright and Freeman would then implicate the network, who would then implicate the sponsor.
Right.
He wanted these guys to roll over on the people above them, but Enright and Freeman did not do that.
Now
they did not want to jeopardize, like Stemple didn't want to anger Enright because Stemple was thinking of his potential future in television. Enright and Freeman, the producers, felt the exact same way. We're not going to roll over on NBC. Because even though we're about to be disgraced on this one show, we can come back. We can create something new. We're not the faces on camera. We're just the names creating the show. NBC will be fine. Yeah. And so that's even what the Scorsese character says. The president of Geritol, the sponsor of the show, he says, no, Enright, Freeman, they'll be fine. He says, what you got to understand, kid, is the public has a very short memory for these sort of things, but corporations, they never forget.
Yeah.
So if Enright and Freeman do right by us, the public will say boo to those guys, but that'll fade. But as long as they're good with us, the corporations will let them back in the door. And they absolutely did. One of the end title cards points out that Enright and Jack Barry came back with The Joker's Wild about 10 years later, and it was 100 times more successful than 21 ever was.
Yeah. Well, and it's just crazy, too, just the power these corporations have. You like you see the NBC exec talking to one of the congressional members, like saying about, oh, your golf game, oh, yes, blah, 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 like talking about, yeah, like, going back to the links. It's just, yeah, like they're all in it together and, you know, are just... It's just, yeah, it's,
yep, all of these stuff that you think probably happens, you know, the secret multimillionaire handshakes, they happen.
Yeah.
These guys are never going to send each other to jail.
This came out in powerhouse of a year, 1994.
Oh boy.
Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump, Shawshank Redemption. The only acting nomination it received was for Paul Scofield for Best Supporting Actor.
Yep.
I could see that.
Now, you just named the four movies you named. You said this movie, Shawshank, Pulp Fiction, and Forrest Gump. Four of those four movies were nominated for Best Picture. Can you name the fifth nominee for Best Picture that year?
All right, 1994. Oh, man.
I'll give you a hint. Once you name these first four movies, in my humble opinion, this fifth film has absolutely no business being in that list.
Jesus. I don't know. As soon as you say it, I'm gonna...
It's fucking Four Weddings and a Funeral.
That's right. Oh, my God.
I mean, yes. I feel like, you know, one of the Muppets, one of these things is not like the other. Like, seriously. How did that movie sneak in there? And what's crazy to me, is Quiz Show and Shawshank were box office failures.
Right. Yeah. I was talking, okay, I forget who I was talking to, but yeah, it's Shawshank even. Like, that's just,
right.
Are you kidding me? Like, and just how it got its legs. I was, William Sadler, I was talking to.
Oh, yeah.
Who, yeah, is just phenomenal. Oh, and,
he's amazing.
Yeah. And, it's just, they didn't do anything in the box office.
No, they died quick deaths in the box office, but Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump, and Four Weddings did gangbusters business.
And then 94, I mean, again, there's even more. I mean, I think Dumb and Dumber came out that year.
Ace Ventura. And The Mask. Like, the 1-2-3 punch from Jim Carrey was all 94. Yep.
Oh,
no,
goodness.
94 was a great movie year.
Yeah, absolutely. And and I know this was nominated for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor. Mm-hmm. I think another one, but it's fantastic. Do you remember off the top? Oh, Best Director, Robert Redford, sure, as well. Do you remember off the top of your head? Have you ever gotten a question on the Schmodown for this movie?
Oh, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I'd like to think if I did, I would have gotten it instantly because, I said, this is one of my top 10 favorite movies.
Yeah. Fantastic. But Quiz Show, man, so glad this was in your list to choose from for us. Appreciate that. Any final thoughts on the film?
My final thoughts on the film, it's so hard to tell stories that are based on real life events. It is so hard to tell a story that has multiple protagonists and to let the audience clearly understand their points of view. And it's hard to tell an interesting story that is a period piece. And Robert Redford nails all three of those things. And also, I want to give a shout out to, I want to say the writer's name is Paul Atanasio. Oh man.
Yep, you're pretty much
Atanasio. Apologies to Paul. I think it's such a well-written script. It's based on the book, one of many. Dick Goodwin wrote many books, but he wrote about his experiences with the Quiz Show investigations in one of his books, and so this is an adaptation of that story in that book. But I think the writer did such a great job, and boy, does it really start there. So between the great writing and the great directing and the terrific acting, I think this is such a compelling, interesting story. And it had, in the real world, such far-reaching effects of the outcome of the real story here and how it shaped one of the main sources of American entertainment for decades to come. I mean, Jeopardy, we wouldn't have shows like we have today without the outcome of what the story in this movie told. So I think it's really important to know if you are a fan of game shows, if you are a fan of television and, you know, live unscripted entertainment, this story is very important.
And everything you just said, I think, can be said about Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Thank you.
You know, it's
it changed the shape of movies and funerals.
Yes.
For decades.
Yeah, for decades.
Decades to come. And meet cutes at weddings.
That's
and
right.
Funerals.
Oh man. Well, Sam, it's been an absolute blast. I'm so glad you filled me with so much knowledge that it will
so
be gone.
Happy I could, but...
it will be gone tomorrow, but
great.
but yeah, no, really appreciate you picking this movie, coming on and talking about it. Do you have anything going on you wanted to promote or anything?
I do.
Like that?
I do. I have plenty of stuff, but I have no air dates or release dates. I can't push that yet, but I can. Let everyone listening know that I am on Cameo.
Ooh.
And I'm having a ball over there. And let me tell you why. Look, you want to ask me to do a birthday greeting, an anniversary greeting, a happy engagement. Look, I'll do it gladly. But my niche on Cameo is something that I don't believe anyone else is doing. Do you have bad news you need to break to someone? Do you need to apologize to someone? And you just can't bring yourself to do it. Do you have no charisma when it comes to explaining that you made a mistake and you are now sorry about that mistake? Do you need to break bad news to someone, but you simply can't find the words that will give them the bad news in a good way? Well, I am your man.
Oh, man.
I have spent a lifetime telling bad news to people.
Do you have an
I have spent a lifetime apologizing because I'm an idiot. So come to me and
do you
let
have a
me.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Ahead. Do you have a highlight of one that
here's
you did?
Here's the thing. So on Cameo, when people request cameos, they can choose to let them either be public or private. So if it's public one, you can like go on my page and see some of them. And I think I've got one or two up there, but by and large, when people come to me with apology or bad news videos, they opt to make them private. So I don't think it's my place to talk about them in specifics. I will say this, in terms of bad news ones, I had a friend who was moving cities and couldn't figure out the way to tell his friend that he was about to move.
Ooh.
And they were not going to be in the same city anymore.
Oh,
and
man.
He knew that the friend was familiar with me, was a fan of mine. So he thought it would be easier if I came to break the news. And so I was very happy to do that. And I've done a number of apology videos. And by and large, they are married people apologizing to their spouses for dumb shit they may have said or done. And and I'm told, either in the reviews or they'll write to me privately afterward and say it went over very well.
So look, I'm waiting for you to get one that said she was very pissed at me for spending this much money on the Cameo. So
I
now,
am not
it may...
that expensive. Okay. There
well,
are cameos
good.
That will
that's
set you
good.
Back into the hundreds of dollars. That
yeah.
ain't me.
I mean, yeah, what it takes like less than 5 minutes. It's just like you do that. It's like, come on. Why are these people out
I
asking?
I take my sweet ass time when
Whoa,
I do cameos. I don't think I've done a cameo video that's run under 3 minutes.
That's beautiful.
Mine that sometimes beautiful. Run 5, 6, 7 minutes because I need the people to understand. I'm not doing it on a lark. Like, I'm there because I care.
Good.
Okay. I you want know? You to get your money's worth out of my cameos, no matter what I'm there wishing you or explaining to you or apologizing for. So come find me on Cameo for all your messaging needs, good or bad.
That is great. There you have it. That's what he's promoting. He's promoting that he can give bad news to people, folks.
In a good way.
On Cameo. In a good way. In a good way. Well, Sam, it's been an absolute blast. You're welcome back anytime. I
Thank
really
you,
appreciate you coming on.
This has been my absolute pleasure. I will gladly come back once your co-host recovers. I'm happy to come back and discuss any of the other movies on that giant list I said.
Well, there you have it, folks. Sam Levine on the Quiz Show, or just Quiz Show. I think it's just called Quiz Show. Robert Redford film. Great, great, great movie. If you haven't checked it out, it's 28 years old. So check it out. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Blockbuster Mentality, Twitter at Blockbuster Cast, and go to our website, blockbustermentality.com. YouTube, our audio, man, our audio is taken off podcast wise, but our YouTube, I don't promote it a lot. But yeah, if you could just go Blockbuster Mentality on YouTube, try to get us some views, we'd appreciate that. You know, maybe we can make it big on YouTube. Could be YouTube stars. Maybe. I don't know. All right, folks, I'm done. Sam Levine, great guy. But all right, well, that is it for me. For Sam, I'm Ben. And as always, grab some popcorn, grab some snacks. We'll catch you guys at the movies.